Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar with Kelly Knepper-Stevens from Stoneleigh Recovery Associates. The Oregon legislature passed a law last year, which went into effect on January 1st, 2018, that makes a number of changes to how debt buyers operate, as well as how collection agencies and debt buyers are allowed to sue for unpaid debts. The law is incredibly complex, includes a large number of provisions, and Kelly thought it would be a great idea to come together and discuss the changes and how they will impact the ARM industry and your business. Let me tell you a little bit about Kelly. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is General Counsel and Chief Compliance Officer for Stoneleigh Recovery Associates, a debt recovery solutions company. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. She advises her clients on the FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, GLBA, HIPAA, and other federal and state regulations. She's a Debt or Receivables Management Association International Certified Receivables Compliance Professional and has earned the Credit and Collection Compliance Officer designation from the American Collectors Association. Before we begin today's discussion and I pass the microphone over to Kelly, I have a couple of quick housekeeping items. Kelly and I encourage everyone to submit questions and we'll do our best to get to as many of them as we can. Questions must be submitted electronically. You can do so by clicking on the Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel. A recording of today's event will be made available on accountsrecovery.net for free in the next day or so. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, while Kelly is a lawyer, she is probably not your lawyer. As such, what is said in today's discussion is for general information purposes only and does not constitute legal or professional advice. Nobody should act on the basis of any material contained in this webinar without obtaining proper legal or other professional advice specific to that to their situation. With that, let me introduce Kelly. Kelly, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Mike Gibb. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this discussion about the new law changes in Oregon. They are really critical to our industry and they are very confusing. So I look forward to talking to everybody about them. And like Mike said, if you have any questions, please submit them as you have them. And we'll do our best to address them as we go through the different sections of the statute. So I want to start just with a little bit of background about the legislative history of the statute. And, you know, some of the work that industry members have been doing on your behalf. So it started as Oregon House Bill 2356. It was introduced by the Oregon Attorney General. It passed the House, and then it passed the Senate, and then it was signed into law by Governor Kate Brown. It was fought, RMA fought the bill for about 6 years. And while 99% of the time, RMA has a track record of success, David Reed, who is the chief government counsel at RMA, described the Oregon bill as one of the 1% of the time where the advocacy was not successful. While it seems like this bill is a debt buyer bill, and that was when you're kind of reading through it, there's a lot of the word debt buyer throughout it, or it might seem like it's a bill that only impacts debt buyers and the collection agencies collecting for debt buyers. Certain provisions of this bill apply to original creditors that are using collection agencies to collect on their accounts. And it also applies to all asset classes. Now, the bill is not really written very well, and I think it's resulted in people having several really good questions about what the actual intent of the bill was and what certain provisions of it mean. And I'm going to try and walk through all of those problems with the bill today, because the lack of clarity in this bill is going to require you and your attorney or your outside counsel to make decisions about how you're going to choose to interpret this bill. So, for example, when I say it applies to all asset classes, the language in the statute really focuses on credit card debt. And so it uses a lot of language that you'd see with credit card, like credit card statements and, you know, the last charge-off statement, but it applies to medical debt. So it doesn't seem like it would apply to medical debt because they're talking about credit card statements or charge-off statements, but the bill applies to all asset classes. The Attorney General and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which I'm going to refer to as DCBS throughout this presentation, can enact rules implementing this act. And they have already started to do so. At least the DCBS has put out some guidance on their website about it. DCBS is also given supervisory authority over debt buyers in this bill, similar to the sort of supervision authority that the CFPB has. All right, so let's move on and talk about definitions. Now, the definitions are addressed, at least for the portion of the statute relating to unlawful collection practices, in the second section of the act. We're going to talk about the definitions that relate to whether or not someone is defined as a debt buyer for the purposes of licensing when we get to the licensing section, which comes in section 4 of the act a little bit later. But the second section of the act amends Oregon Revised Statute 646.693, and that's the section that lists out unlawful debt collection practices. I'm starting here with the definitions because this section and definitions applies to both Section 1 and Section 2 of the Act, as well as certain portions of Section 3. And you see why I'm talking about how this Act is moderately complicated and confusing. But for the purpose here, a debt buyer regularly is an entity that regularly engages in the business of purchasing charged-off debt for the purpose of collecting the charged-off debt or hiring another person to collect or bring legal action to collect the charged-off debt. So it covers both active and passive debt buyers. It does not include a person that acquires a charged off debt as an incidental part of acquiring a portfolio of debt that is predominantly not charged off debt. Additionally, I think it's important to point out, because I was thinking through this later after I had written the slides, that there is also a definition of debt in this statute in the same section. Which means any obligation or alleged obligation that arises out of a consumer transaction, right? So when it's talking about charged off debt, it's talking about charged off consumer transactions. The definition of debt collector is amended to cover an entity that collects or attempts to collect a debt owed or alleged to be owed to a creditor or a debt buyer. So they added the words "or a debt buyer" to the statute. Otherwise, the definition of debt collector has not changed here. All right. Let's move on to the initial pleading requirements. So this comes from Part 1 of the Act, Section 1, and it sets out new pleading requirements. It's an entirely new provision. They're not amending an existing provision. They are adding pleading requirements that apply to a debt buyer or a debt collector working on the behalf of a debt buyer. And essentially, a court is not permitted to enter judgment for a debt buyer or a debt collector that has not complied with these initial pleading requirements. The Act allows for a debtor to petition the court for relief from any judgment that does not comply with the requirements in this section. So here are the original pleading requirements: original creditor's name, and these things must be included in the initial pleadings when seeking a court action on the debt. So original creditor's name, written as the original creditor used in dealings with the debtor, the name, the address, the telephone number of the person that owns the debt, and a statement as to whether the person is a debt buyer, the last four digits of the original creditor's account number, and the date on which the debt buyer purchased the debt. Now, this is initial pleadings requirement part one, because we're going to move to the next slide, which involves the second set of initial pleading requirements. I tried to put it all on one slide and realized that I had way too much info on one slide, so I divided it into two. And again, these apply to a debt buyer or a debt collector working on behalf of a debt buyer in an initial pleading. They are also required to include an itemized statement that shows the amount and date of the debtor's last payment, the amount of and the date of the last payment made prior to default or charge-off. So in this case, if you have a last payment prior to charge-off, you would have to include that as well as the last payment after charge-off. The balance due on the debt, the charge-off date, the amount and rate of interest, fees, and charges. And this has three parts: imposed by the original creditor, imposed by the debt buyer and imposed by any previous owner. And those all have the if known, right? So not only do you have to provide the amount and rate of interest, fees, and charges imposed by the original creditor if you know it, you have to include the amount and rate of interest, fees, and charges imposed by any previous owner, as well as the amount and rate of interest, fees, and charges imposed by the debt buyer. Additionally, the attorney's fees that the debt buyer or the debt collector is seeking, as well as any other fee, cost, or charge the debt buyer seeks to recover. Those are the things that need to be itemized in an initial pleading. And this went into effect, as Mike said at the beginning, on January 1st, 2018. So this needs to be happening right now if you're filing a lawsuit to collect on the debt and you are a debt buyer. All right, let's move to unlawful collection practices. So the first section talked about of the Act talked about the litigation requirements for debt buyer lawsuits. Now we're moving to section 2 of the Act, which lists out the amendments to the Oregon Revised Statutes, sort of FDCPA. And there are several amendments and additions that have been made to this section of the statute. What is really key is that this first slide here is talking about the amendments that were made to section 2, ORS 646.6392. They apply to a debt collector while collecting or attempting to collect a debt. So if you remember, the definition of a debt collector that we talked about in one of the first slides is an entity by direct or indirect action who conducts a practice or who conducts, it's actually very I'm actually reading you from the statute. This is what it says. Now, the definition of debt collector is any entity by direct or indirect action conduct or practice collects or attempts to collect a debt owed or alleged to be owed to a creditor or a debt buyer, right? So what I'm saying here is that these amendments apply to all third-party debt collectors collecting on a debt owed to a creditor or a debt buyer. So it applies to your original creditor accounts. There is a very long list, in fact, 20 to be exact, from section A to section T of unlawful collection practices in this section that you want to make sure that you review. Most of these unlawful collection practices obtained in this particular section of this Oregon Unlawful Collection Practices Act already existed and track the FDCPA. However, there are a few new ones that I want to draw your attention to. And here they are on this slide. So the first one is, it is now an unlawful collection practice to collect interest or any other charges not permitted by law or the underlying agreement with the consumer. It is now an unlawful collection practice to collect a medical debt qualifying for reimbursement under Medicaid or Oregon statute. It is now an unlawful collection practice to file a lawsuit when it's barred by the statute of limitations. And finally, and this is the real important one that I think impacts all of us, and this is the critical one where we had to change our policies and procedures and make sure that we were in compliance. It makes it an unlawful collection practice to not provide the required validation within 30 days. I want to pause for a minute here. We're going to go through what the validation requirements are because those are also changed in this statute or in this act. But I want to pause here because there is no safe harbor language in the statute. If you cannot provide the required items in 30 days, you are in violation of this statute. Now, if you remember in New York, when they implemented their substantiation provisions, the New York DFS provided clarification that if you couldn't provide the required substantiation, I think in New York you have 60 days to do it, you could still send the consumer a notice of satisfaction within that time frame and not violate the statute. Here, we don't have that safe harbor language. So if you cannot provide the required validation, you will be in violation of the statute, and you have to provide it within 30 days. So this went into effect on January 1st, 2018. If you have not already done so, you need to immediately update your policies and procedures to make sure that you're including that you will be providing this information within 30 days when there is a dispute. Now, this section of the Act is governed by the Attorney General's office. So I know I've been in communication with David Reed, who's been amazing in arguing on our behalf in Oregon. I know that they are working, trying to get the Attorney General's office to issue some kind of similar clarification document, an opinion or whatever, just like the New York DFS did, providing some kind of safe harbor in the event that you cannot get these documents. However, at this time, there has been no opinion. There is no safe harbor. So you want to make sure that if you cannot provide all of the required documents at the outset, before you even initiate collection, then you probably might not want to be collecting on those accounts. So let's take a look at what is required for validation. Now, that particular section, this unlawful practice that requires you to provide validation within 30 days is little t of ORS 646639, 2t. And in that section, it says, all right, look to section 4B to see what you need to provide for validation. And here is that list of items that must be provided after a dispute. Itemization of the charge-off balance, the last amount paid and the date, both before and after charge-off, right? So the last amount paid and the date of that payment before the account was charged off, as well as the last amount paid and date after charge-off, if any. The interest rate, any fees or charges imposed by the original creditor, by the current owner, and by any previous debt buyer, including any attorney's fees that are being sought. So again, similar to the litigation, that's three separate itemizations for interest rate, and fees or charges, because you need to itemize them out by who was charging them, the original creditor, any previous buyer, or the current owner, if you are charging interest and fees or other charges. The bill of sale, if there is one. And then original account level documentation, either the agreement between the consumer and the creditor, a statement with the last payment or last charge or last balance transfer, if it's a credit card or similar. You also need to include the original creditor's name, written as the original creditor used the name in the dealing with the debtor, the name and address and telephone number of the person that owns the debt, and a statement as to whether the person is a debt buyer. So these are all the validation requirements. These documents must be provided by the debt collector collecting on the account of either a debt buyer or an original creditor within 30 days of the consumer's request. If you can't provide it within 30 days, at this point, you're in violation of the statute. You want to make sure that you're updating your policies and procedures and that you're having conversations with the account owners to make sure that they can provide all this information to you before you start any debt collection activity on that account in Oregon. All right, let's move on to, I see there's several questions coming through, so let me take a minute here. Unfortunately, the question that I see here is, the requirement around providing info on charge-off date seems to apply only to credit card debt. Yes, so this is a very good question. So the requirements around as I was saying at the very beginning, a lot of the language here in this statute is written as if they're talking about credit card debt. However, for this particular unlawful collection practice, which requires the debt collector to provide this information to the consumer within 30 days of request, it doesn't have any limitations on who it's collecting for, right? So we know that it does apply to consumer debt, but other than that, it's going to apply to any type of asset class. So whether you're collecting on auto accounts for the original owner, or whether you are collecting on medical debt, it's going to apply. And I think that what you need to do is when you go through the list of documents that you have to provide, you know, if it's a medical debt, you're going to want to provide the type of similar documentation, right? Like if you don't have a charge-off statement, because there is no charge-off statement with medical debt, that's going to make sense, right? You're obviously not going to be able to provide it because that type of document does not exist. Similar to the fact that you can't provide a copy of the bill of sale if the debt was never sold, right? So that's not something that you're going to have to provide. But you are going to have to, you know, provide evidence of the agreement between the original creditor and the debtor. So in a medical context, you know, you would want to provide, you know, if you have it, the admittance information and anything that was signed by the patient when they were, you know, in the doctor's office, as well as all the bills that you have to show it. And of course, you know, I'm just talking generically here. You'd also have to make sure that you were in compliance with HIPAA, of course, and providing, you know, the limited amount of information that you would need to protect, you know, the PHI. Yes. So the next question is, how do you feel about the validation requirements when attempting to collect on a judgment? And that, so, and again, this individual who's asking this question says, you know, the New York DSF rules kind of make it clear, but it's very silent in the Oregon requirements. It is very silent in the Oregon requirements. And as a result, until we have some sort of guidance from the Oregon Attorney General's office, I would take a really close look at it. And I would presume that it applies, because if you are a debt collector collecting on a judgment, this would apply for you. This unlawful collection practices, Oregon 646-6392 is going to apply to you, whether it's a judgment or a medical debt or whatever. And I think that's where, you know, we really have to hope that the Oregon Attorney General's office will listen critically to the issues that are being raised by RMA. And if you have issues where you're finding that it's unclear, you know, and you're a member of RMA, definitely let them know. They're already on it. I've been talking with David Reed about this a lot, and they're doing everything they can to try and get some sort of guidance from the Attorney General's office. But of course, you know, hopefully that guidance will come out and help make it more clear, as opposed to making it more cumbersome or troublesome. Yes. So another attendee pointed out that subsection T states within 30 days after the date of the debtor's request. So, and not necessarily within 30 days after the receipt of a dispute. So definitely make sure that you're taking a close look at the specific language of the statute. I think that's pretty critical. So then the question that comes from that is, if a consumer does not request the specific information under 4B, would it be a violation to send what we would normally send for verification, which might not include all of the items under 4E? Okay. Oh, which might not include all the items under 4B. Sorry, I see that fixed part there. Okay. So if the consumer does not request the documentation, then you don't have to provide it, right, under this portion of the section of the statute. I'm looking specifically at number T, right, from Oregon 646-6392 T, not providing the validation within 30 days of a request. And so I think that it has to be requested in order to trigger your obligation to provide those documents within 30 days. So hopefully that's answering that question. Okay, so now I'm going to try and keep it. I tried to make these slides so that it would parse this out to make it very clear, because the next section and this slide that we've moved to here concerning unlawful collection practices is only relating to debt buyers or debt collectors acting for a debt buyer. Because this is subsection 4, and this is a new part that's being added to the unlawful debt collection practices. And this is adding a list of unlawful collection practices that only apply to a debt buyer or a debt collector acting on behalf of a debt buyer. So I think that this clarification is trying to suggest that this little section of unlawful collection practices is only applying to debt buyers and those third-party collectors that are collecting for a debt-buying company. So here are the additional list of unlawful collection practices for those folks. Filing a legal action when the SOL has run, filing a legal action without sufficient documentation, failing to provide a receipt after a cash payment, or a receipt if requested, and then failing to provide the validation documentation after request. And that provision also reflects those same listed validation documentation in 4B. However, it notes that once you've provided those documents, then it's not unlawful to continue your collection efforts. Okay? So again, this part seems really repetitive because a debt collector has to provide that information under Section T of this same portion of the statute. But again, it's making clear that a debt buyer or a debt collector must provide that validation documentation after request. All right, let's move on to the next slide. This is the really confusing section, right? And this is the section where a lot of my original creditor clients look at it and they say, well, wait a second, does any of this actually apply to me at all? So in the very last edit that this act is making to the Oregon Unlawful Collection Practices Law is this Part 5. And Part 5 says that and I had to write it out here, I mean, because I don't know any other way to describe this without giving you the exact language, especially because of its lack of clarity. It says a debt collector is not acting on a debt buyer's behalf and is not subject to the duties to which a debt buyer is subject to in Section 1, which is the initial litigation requirements, or Section 2 of the Act, which would really be just the last slide, because that's the only slide that applies to just debt buyers. If the debt collector is working for an owner that retains a direct interest in the debt, or if the debt is not a debt that the debt buyer purchased. So what does this mean? I am not sure what they were trying to get across here. And I try and take a very conservative approach to this simply because we don't have the guidance yet to know what to do. So when I had an original creditor say to me, well, does this mean that I don't have to provide those documentation within 30 days? I said, I don't think so, because this seems to only be applying to, you know, collection for debt buyers, right? So I don't think it gets them out of that little T that is from ORS 646-6392. What I think the drafters were trying to say is that anything in the Act that applies only to debt buyers, which is the initial pleading requirement and the unlawful collection practices, that those don't apply to the accounts of original creditors. I think that's what they were trying to say. But to be honest with you, it's very poorly written because a debt buyer, by their very nature of their business model, they own the debt and they retain a direct interest in the debt that is transferred to the third-party debt collector to collect on their behalf. So I'm not sure what the intent was of this language and where they were going with it or what it meant. And until we have clarification, I'm sorry, I think that I have nothing really great to offer on this, but I think you really want to take a look at it carefully. I think you should take a look at it carefully with your outside counsel and try to come to a decision about how this may apply to you. And you know, definitely this is another section of the law that RMA knows about and is hoping to get clarification on from the Attorney General's office. All right, so let's move to the next section, which is debt buyer licensing and debt buyer licenses being required. Oh, we have more questions. I didn't realize that I had to scroll down. So let's take a couple of these questions. David Reed, who is participating here, said, by the way, the Attorney General has orally indicated that if you cannot, yes, I did know this, but I wasn't sure I should, I'll say it out loud, but I'll say it out loud. The Attorney General has orally indicated that if you cannot provide the information within 30 days, that validation information. So if you're a debt collector, you have to provide it no matter what account you're collecting on. You have to provide it within 30 days of request. The Attorney General has indicated that you can close that account down and not be in violation. But, and this is a key point here, since nothing is in writing, it should not be relied upon. So it appears that the Attorney General, if they do put it in writing, will put in something, a favorable sort of safe harbor language, but it doesn't exist at this time. Okay. Let's go on with the debt buyer license, and then I will take a look at the next questions that we have regarding dispute. So the debt buyer license requirements are the next several sections of the statute. I think it's section 3 through section 10 of this act. And it requires that everyone who is a debt buyer gets a license by January 1st, 2018. So you should have gotten that 4 days ago. The applications already went out. They went out in November, so the application is available. Anyone, it applies to any debt buyer who has Oregon consumer accounts in their collection portfolios. Passive debt buyers, right? Debt buyers who own the debt but do not collect on it themselves only need to have a debt buyer license. You do not also need to have a third-party collection license too. And this is important because, you know, this distinction has and question has come up in several other states. But here, there is both a debt buyer license now and a third-party collection license. If you are a passive debt buyer that does not do any collection, you do not need to have a third-party collection license as well. I know that question has been asked because a lot of passive debt buyers went ahead prior to this law even being in existence and got a third-party collection license just to be safe. But now you don't need to do that if you're not doing third-party collections. All you need is the passive debt buyer license. Active debt buyers need to have both a debt collection license and a debt buyer license. Failure to be licensed can result in a maximum $5,000 penalty for each violation. There are a couple different exceptions to this licensing requirement for attorneys. For one that I put here is there is an exception for attorneys who are licensed in Oregon. You do not need to get a debt buyer license if you engage in debt buyer activity only incidentally in the practice of law. Now, I know that we had a question earlier, even before the session started, about whether or not someone who purchases commercial accounts would need to be licensed as a debt buyer. And that is a very interesting question. And I kind of went back and forth on that because Section 4 of the Act is the section that has the licensing requirement. And it says, a person may not engage in debt buying in this state unless the person obtains or renews a license. Okay. So what does debt buying mean? Debt buying is defined in Section 3 of the Act relating to the licensing portion. And debt buying means conducting business as a debt buyer. Section 3 says debt buyer has the meaning given in Section ORS 646-639, which was actually amended by the statute, so it's in Section 2. The meaning is a person that regularly engages in the business of purchasing charged-off debt for the purposes of collecting the charge-off debt or hiring another person to collect or bring legal action to collect the charged-off debt. Charged-off debt is not defined in Section 3, but it is defined in Section 2 and also in the unlawful practices, and that says a debt that a creditor treats as a loss or expense and not as an asset. And debt is similarly defined in Section 2. It's defined as an obligation that arises out of a consumer transaction. Okay, so breaking that all down, it seems like since debt is defined as an obligation that arises out of a consumer transaction, that it probably means that if you are a commercial debt collector, debt buyer, if you're a commercial debt buyer, you would not need a debt buying license. However, it's not super clear because those definitions aren't coming from the licensing section of the statute. But I think you have a really good argument that because of statutory construction, you can look at definitions in the same section of the Act. And because debt is defined as arising from a consumer transaction, that it probably does not include commercial debt. But I will tell you this, the Attorney General is, or RMA, is also looking into this and trying to get clarification. And not from the Attorney General's office here. Here they would just need it from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. They've been very helpful in providing guidance, as you're going to see in a moment. They've actually posted several things on their website that has been very helpful, and they have a great working relationship with RMA. So I think we might be able to get some clarification and real confirmation that it does not include commercial debt, that folks who are debt buyers of commercial debt would not need a license. But again, you should definitely talk that over with your attorney. Okay. So let's move on. They did.
Kelly, sorry. Let me interrupt one quick second before you move on to the next slide. David Reed did reach out again with a clarification, and he said that active debt buyers who do not perform third-party collections only need a debt buyer license.
Yes. Active debt buyers who do not perform third-party collections only need a debt buyer license, because I was saying passive. Okay, thank you, David Reed. This is why I'm very glad you're on this session. I did ask him to present with me, but he was like, no, thank you. All right, let's take a look at the next slide quickly and then get back to some of the other questions that we have asked here before we finish out the hour. So DCBS did post a licensure safe harbor language, and RMA sent this out to their members. They published this at the request of RMA, a safe harbor notice on enforcement actions for folks that haven't actually been issued the license on January 1st, but that had already applied. And so go ahead and take a look at this slide. This explains what the exception would be. And hopefully all of you have already, that needed to, have already applied for your license and either have it or are relying on this safe harbor to continue to collect. But if you do not have a license and you didn't already apply, you would want to stop collection activity as a debt buyer until you have your license, as it is now required and went into effect on January 8th. Let's briefly talk about the penalties on the next slide. The penalties come from Section 11 of the bill. And essentially, the penalties come directly from DCBS. When they are conducting an investigation or an enforcement action, and they find that someone who engages in debt buying has violated either ORS 646, 639, which is the unlawful practices statute, or another section of this act, or another applicable law, the director can suspend or deny their license, impose a $5,000 penalty for each violation. It goes in detail through the violations, and it's pretty intense, because each instance of a violation is a separate violation, and each day of a continuous violation is a separate violation. But they put a cap on it so that a continuous violation penalty, each one will be $5,000 until you get to $20,000, and then that's just the penalty for the continuous violation. What about your liability that you might have for a consumer in court for a violation of this? Under the Oregon Unlawful Collection Practices Statute, this isn't something that changed. This has been in effect since that statute was enacted. There is civil liability for violating the unlawful collection practices, and a consumer can sue you in court to stop the unlawful practice. They can recover either their actual damages or $200, whichever is greater. They can recover punitive damages, attorney's fees, and any other equitable relief that the court feels. It's not as bad as the FDCPA in that it's not, $1,000 per violation. However, don't forget that this is a separate portion. You're still liable in an enforcement action for that $5,000 penalty for each violation. All right, so let's get back to some of the questions that we have here. And you can turn, Mike, to the last slide. The last slide we have here are some additional resources. If you want to take a look at the full text of this bill, that's a link to it. If you, and I highly recommend it, the debt buyer page at the DCBS website is very helpful. And there's also new information now on NMLS on their Oregon page about the licensing requirement. All right, so let's see where we are here. Isn't any dispute of the balance or existence of a dispute requiring the documentation? So that's a very good question. And for the purposes of this question, I'm going to be referring to the section of the statute that is Section T that just requires a debt collector to provide this information within 30 days after the date of the debtor's request. Okay? So, it doesn't get into any other language concerning like the language that you see in the FDCPA about disputes. It simply makes it an unlawful collection practice to collect or attempt to collect a debt before providing to the debtor within 30 days after the date of the debtor's request all of the documents listed that were on that slide and that you can find in subsection 4B, right? So, as to your question, it doesn't, if the debtor requests the information, it doesn't have like a dispute or, so for the purposes of my agency, you know, if a consumer called up and orally said, hey, I have a question about this or anything that I would define as like a dispute for the purposes of the FDCPA, and we have a pretty conservative definition of what that is. I'm going to go ahead and provide all of these documents that are required by this section. Hopefully that effectively answers your question. So the next person says, so if the consumer states in writing, I dispute this debt, are we obligated to send everything under 4B? So assuming that you are, and I'm just talking about Section T, when the debt collector, right, is collecting or attempting to collect a debt, it's an unlawful practice if they get this question, within 30 days of the date of the debtor's request, you have to provide all these documents, right? So if the consumer states in writing, I dispute this debt. So I see where you're going with this question. Your question is, what exactly is it that the consumer needs to say in order to trigger your obligation to send this long list of information, which includes an itemization of interest, fees, charges, from the original creditor, from any previous purchaser, and from the current owner, right? Which is a lot. That is something that I cannot answer for you. That is something that you have to devise in consultation with the people at your office, with perhaps your outside counsel, but you need to get together and talk about it. I think you should keep in mind that, this is Oregon, that it is a state where you wanna make sure that you are liberally construing what type of question or request that the consumer is making. So I think you're saying, do I have to provide that itemization if the consumer says to me, I dispute this debt, or do I only provide it to them if they ask me for an itemization? Do I only provide them the bill of sale if they ask me for the itemization? I'm not interpreting it that way. I'm interpreting this in a very, liberal fashion. I said I'm being conservative. So I'm being conservative and I'm interpreting it liberally, such that if somebody disputes, I'm going to try and provide them every single piece of information that they have here. The next question is, does closing the account down for the Attorney General mean closing at the collection agency or getting the account owner to expunge. So I'm reading that out loud. Perhaps David Reed can tell us if the Attorney General maybe specified when he was talking to them about that provision. So in New York, it means that the account owner must expunge. So my guess would be that the Attorney General in Oregon would similarly expect that if these documents could not be provided, that the account would be expunged. The account would ultimately be killed and some sort of notice would be issued to the consumer letting them know, you know, this account has been satisfied. That's the language that New York uses. But again, at this point, we don't have that official guidance in writing. We just have the words that they have said. So we're going to eagerly wait to hear and hope that we're able to get some more guidance from them. What about debt buyers who operate in Oregon but don't have Oregon consumers in their debt portfolio? Do they need an Oregon debt buyer and or collector license? If you are not collecting on any accounts in Oregon, if there are no accounts in Oregon in your portfolio, right, then you do not need to have an Oregon debt collection license, and you would not need to have an Oregon debt buyer license if you were a debt buyer, meaning the definition under the statute. The only time that you need to have it is if you have those accounts in your portfolio and you're attempting to collect on them. The next question is, if the only purchase debt we have is now in civil judgments taken by our collection agency, do we need to have a debt buyer's license? We have canceled all debt buyer debt not in judgment. That question I would need more information on in order to properly answer, because if you're civil judge. So again, I would refer back to kind of the definitions that they have. So if the judgment relates to a debt that was a charged off debt, I would think that you might need to have a license. And that's when I went through, right? The licensing requirement is a person may not engage in debt buying in this state unless the person obtains or has a license. And debt buying is conducting business as a debt buyer. A debt buyer is a person who engages in the business of purchasing charged off debt for the purpose of collecting the charged off debt or hiring another person to collect or bring legal action to collect the charged off debt. So I think right there, if you don't meet the term of debt collector or debt buyer there, you might not have to get a license. And additionally, it would depend on whether or not that debt is charged off and whether it's consumer debt. So those were the questions that I would be thinking about when trying to determine whether or not your civil judgments would require you to have a debt buyer license in the state of Oregon under this law. Yep. So David Reed filled in and said expunged. So that goes back to the question about what do you do if you cannot provide the documentation that is required by the statute, and the Attorney General's opinion is that then the debt itself would have to be expunged. Thank you, David Reed, for clarifying that and being there. And I think there's a panel was put together between debt buyers and other representatives, and there's several folks from our industry. And I think some of them might be on this call because I see some questions here. It's really more of a comment of someone who probably sits on this panel that has been working directly with DCDS to help provide industry feedback about the law and the licensing requirements. And I really, by the way, appreciate your service on that commission and your efforts on our behalf there. But they did get clarification about several items. A lot of that clarification you can find on the DCBS debt buyer page and through RMA, and I've been talking about it throughout. But one of the folks that was probably participating in that, David Blasio, mentioned that he doesn't recall having any discussions with DCBS regarding expungement. I think those would be the discussions with the Attorney General's office. Can you send the slides with the resource links to the participants? Mike, that's a question for you.
Yes, absolutely. We will make the audio recording available as well as an audio plus slides recording available on the site. Happy to do that.
All right, great. Well, I don't see any other questions here. So I am going to thank everyone for coming. This law is really complex and confusing. And so I was really, I asked Mike Gibb, I said, hey, could you do a webinar on this? I think it would be really useful. And he said, do you want to do it? And I was like, well, I guess so, because I really need to understand it. So it was very helpful for me to go through this and to help prepare these slides, to try and organize this information. But even in so doing, it just brought up more questions because some of the provisions are not written very well. So I appreciate your time here. If anybody has any other questions, please feel free to send me an email. Mike Gibb can send my email information out when he sends you the link to these slides. Thanks again, everyone, for being here. And thanks,
Steve. On behalf of everybody, Kelly, let me thank you. This was a yeoman's effort in getting all this information together. And I think it was incredibly well done and well explained, to the extent that, you know, things can be explained, because clearly there are still some issues that need to be resolved. And hopefully RMA will continue to make progress with both the AG and the DCBS and getting that clarification and clarity that the industry is looking for. So on behalf of everybody, Kelly, thank you for taking the time today and doing such a great job. Also, thank you to everybody who participated and asked questions and interacted with us. Thanks to those who signed up. I hope everyone's walking away at least somewhat. I think everyone's walking away more educated. It has definitely more answers. There still are some questions, and hopefully we'll get the answers, and I'll be publishing as much information as I can. So look to accountsrecovery.net for additional articles and information in the near future as that information becomes available.
Wait, there's another question. Is there a definitive validation period like with the FDCPA? No, there's not. It just is that one line that says, if you get this request, you must provide it within 30 days. And then, as a small aside, then there's another provision, which is number 4, which says you fail to provide the validation documents after request. Where did I put this statute? I have it here on my desk too. So there's two different sections that talk about it. The one that applies generically to just debt collectors collecting on debt, it says you have to do it within 30 days of a request, but it doesn't have that. The use of 30 days just means you need to provide those documents within 30 days. It's not like the FDCPA where you have the 30-day period with which to dispute, and I can't assume that it's valid until, you know, that 30-day period is over. It's not like that. It just is a very simple, if you get a request, you have to comply with it within 30 days. And then Section 4 of that statute goes ahead and says, it's for... fails to provide the debtor after the debt buyer or debt collector receives payment in cash. That's the payment receipt. I'm sorry, it's just so detailed. Well, anyways, I wrote down on the slide, fails to provide the validation documentation after request. So I think for the debt buyer one, it doesn't even give a time period. So you have to rely on that 30 days, and there's no limit. The consumer can make this request at any point. That's the important key thing there, is that at any point during collections, if the consumer makes this request, you have 30 days as a debt collector to provide it to the consumer. Thank you. Thank you for that last question. That's an important one.
Well, thank you for that last answer. I don't see any more questions. And before any more come in, we'll give Kelly a break on this. Thank you again, Kelly. Thank you to everybody. Hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day and the new year. Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Yes, Happy New Year.